of the Joys and Sorrows. I hope you can dance to it. Oh, that's going to sound good. So remember, if you go back to listen to the sermon, that that first couple seconds, those are a lulu. Well, it's like back to school, kind of learning your way around again. Thanks for reading those announcements. I wrote two of those announcements, and those are literature, huh? The length of those. We could probably summarize those in the future and not read the whole thing, but the announcement for the workshops coming up. Okay, I left you in June with the story of Noah and his sons. Remember that? You've been back and listened to it several times, right? How he blessed Shem and Japheth, but cursed Ham for seeing him lying drunk and naked, as if the son was to blame for the father's condition. This unfortunate series of events followed Noah's great success in building the ark, which the Bible tells us was the first great human building project. That's something worth remembering on this day before Labor Day, a holiday or a holy day that brings the holiness of human work into focus. Okay, so now, Shem begets one line, Japheth another, while the cursed Ham begets Cush and Mizraim and Put and Canaan, and Cush begot Nimrod. He began to be a mighty one in the earth. He was a mighty hunter before the Lord, wherefore it is said, like Nimrod, a mighty hunter before the Lord. You gotta love a pair of lines like that. And the beginning of his kingdom was Babel and Erech and Akkad and Calneh, all in the land of Shinar. That's the whole Bible account of Nimrod. Not much, but enough for the rabbis and other teachers and storytellers to build into one of their great extra-biblical legends. They start by reminding us, what their spin on this story, by reminding us how when Adam and Eve broke the rules, ate the forbidden fruit, and realized that they were naked, they first tried covering themselves with leaves. Remember that story? But when God found these naughty nudies hiding in the garden, he blew off the leaves and then clothed them in the skins of some poor animals who were unlucky enough to be grazing nearby. So far, all of this is found in the Bible. But now it's time for some fun as the creative storytellers explain how the first couple passed these skins on to their descendants until they came to Noah, who brought them along in the ark. Later, they were stolen by Ham, who gave them to Cush, who passed them to his own son, Nimrod. It was Nimrod who first discovered that these garments had a wonderful property. He who wore them was both invincible and irresistible. Beasts and birds fell down before Nimrod as soon as they caught sight of him, and he was equally victorious in his combats with men. The source of his unconquerable strength was not known to them. They attributed it to his personal prowess, and therefore they appointed him king over themselves. He chose Shinar as his capital. Thence he extended his dominion farther and farther until he rose by cunning and force to be the sole ruler of the whole world. You can just see this is something you'd want to tell, you'd make a movie with casts of thousands, Cecil B. DeMille or someone like that. So I guess it seems like a good time to pause for some music while the opening credits roll. Deborah? Thank you. So how does Nimrod choose to exercise his new political power? Get this more in front of me. Is that better?
Yes.
Okay, good. He starts by commissioning huge monuments to himself, drawing his subjects into a cult of his personality. And things start to escalate quickly. He set himself up as a god and made a seat for himself in imitation of the seat of God. It was a tower built out of a round rock, and on it he placed a throne of cedar wood upon which arose one above the other four thrones of iron, copper, silver, and gold. Crowning all upon the golden throne lay a precious stone, round in shape and gigantic in size. This served him as a seat, and as he sat upon it, all nations came and paid him divine homage. Nimrod next decides to mount an invasion of heaven itself. So in these days before spacecraft, the only way to attack the heavens is by sending your armies up some kind of structure. A multinational crew of 600,000 men, along with their families, come from all over the world to work on the first great building project after the Ark, the Tower of Babel, his capital city. The tower to trump all towers. Oh, people, come on. Come on. I wouldn't do that. Okay, many, many years were passed in building the tower. It reached so great a height that it took a year to mount to the top. A brick was therefore more precious in the sight of the builders than a human being. If a man fell to his death, no one took notice of it. But if a brick dropped, they wept because it would take a year to replace it. They would not permit a pregnant woman to interrupt herself in her work of brickmaking. When she went into labor, molding bricks, she gave birth to her child, and tying it round her body in a sheet, she went on molding bricks. Thus, Nimrod founded not only the first multinational capital enterprise, but also the world's first HMO, or profit-driven health system. A man dies, and so what? A brick falls, and oh my God, a brick. Lost time or material is mourned grievously. A lost person, barely noticed. Giving birth to a child is no excuse for a woman to rest. There are bricks to be made, people. Bricks! And now Nimrod's archers start to shoot, quote, arrows toward heaven which would come down covered with blood. They cried, "We have slain all who are in heaven." Thereupon God said, "Let's go down and confound their language so that they may not understand one another's speech." Thenceforth, none knew what the other spoke. One would ask for mortar, the other handed him a brick. In a rage, he would throw the brick at his partner and kill him. Many died this way. Some God transformed into phantoms. Some he set against each other, so they fell in combat. Others were scattered over the earth. As for the unfinished tower, a part sank into the earth, and another part was consumed by fire. Only one third of it remained standing. The place of the tower has never lost its peculiar quality. Whoever passes it forgets all he knows. Do you know where Shinar is? It's in today's Iraq. Anyway, exciting stuff. Is this pretty much how you remembered the story of the Tower of Babel? The tone, if not the details? It's how you usually see it represented in art. From Bruegel the Elder to good old John Huston, painters and rabbis, movie makers and ministers all find in the tower story, a great way to warn us about the arrogance of power, to knock us down a peg. And I agree that that is a good thing to do from time to time. For guys like Nimrod, of course, not folks like you or me. But I also need to tell you that this is not the story of Babel as it's told in the Bible. You were probably expecting a rip-snorting adventure when you came to hear a sermon called In Search of the Lost Ark, and maybe also hoping to learn why I spelled that last word with a C instead of a K. I hope that you don't think I tricked you with an exciting trailer when you learn that the Bible itself has nothing to say about a comic book villain attacking heaven, no magic clothes to give him superpowers, and no bloodshed. The scripture version is actually much simpler, much quieter, and much more hopeful. I want to share with you now my own translation from the Hebrew original. I like to work directly with scriptures in their original languages whenever I can, not because I expect to make startling new discoveries about secret or hidden meanings, but because reading in the original slows me down. Whenever we go slower, we notice things that we might otherwise miss. So let's read. The whole earth was one lip. That's how it's put. One lip, or language, or way of using your lips and tongue. And words were ones, all the same, all one. And in their pulling up, and this means their migration, their pulling up, expressed as a process of first putting down and pulling up tent stakes. In their pulling up, this is our wandering motherless child, a wandering people. In their pulling up from the east, so they must have been headed west, they came upon a valley in the land of Shinar, and they stayed there. So these nomads stopped moving for a while. Now what? And each man said to his companion or neighbor, "Come on, we'll make bricks and burn them hard." So they had brick for stone and mud for mortar. These are humble materials instead of the cut stone of palaces that the Bible uses to describe the dwellings of the proud, the high and the mighty. Just brick. So let's review for a moment. Following their time together on Noah's Ark, the people share a common language. They can communicate freely with their fellow travelers. And as soon as they slow down in their migrations, this language, this ability to communicate, leads to a set of developments. They're able to pool their resources and their expertise. Come, let's make bricks. This simple advance in technique and cooperation quickly leads to another. Then they said, "Come on, let's build for ourselves a city." Come, let's build for ourselves a city. They quickly see how, brick by brick, something much more elaborate can be developed and extended horizontally. But they also imagine a vertical dimension to this project. Let's build ourselves a city and a tower with its head in the heavens. And now they add a dimension of purpose about just why they're doing it, kind of a mission statement. So, by so doing, we will make for ourselves a name. Why make a name? What for? It's for the sake of preservation and continuity. We'll make for ourselves a name, lest we be scattered over the face of the earth. Lest we get scattered. They want to preserve their identity, to maintain it over time. They dread being scattered. Nafutz in Hebrew. Who wants to be nafutz? They want to grow horizontally, vertically, over time, maintaining identity and making meaning all the while. Pooling their resources of talent and technique, common purpose, and above all, a common language that everyone understands, things start to move at a dizzying speed. Tent-staking nomads become a community of builders for whom not even the sky is the limit. Reaching through space and over time, they're headed where no one has gone before. There's no ill will suggested. No hubris. Just a bit of a rush as they get swept up in suddenly doing what they find they can do. They're making great progress, working together, communicating well, neighbor to neighbor. If they lose sight of each other or let their project overshadow human need, the scripture doesn't tell us. If anything, the text stresses the humbleness of both the building materials and the builders themselves. It's only when their God enters the picture that trouble starts. Then Yahweh descended to see the city and the tower that the children of Adam, literally the children of the earth or soil, the tower that the children of Adam had built. And Yahweh said, "Behold, a single people and one language, and this is the beginning of what they'll do. And so now, not impossible for them, is all that they plan to do. That is, they can do whatever they set their minds to." This God doesn't say that there's anything inherently wrong with the people's project. Couldn't a tower with its head in the heavens be a place to worship their maker? And he's a maker, right? It's not reproduction like in some sacred stories. This is work, right? The Bible told us earlier how God took soil and breathed on it to make these earthlings, these atoms. Now they also take soil and they bake it strong with the breath of fire, stack it upon itself to draw closer to the one who made them in his image. They're imitating him. Yeah. Why not? The Bible doesn't answer, but tells us only that for some reason, he says to himself, "Come on, let's go down and confuse their language so that each man does not understand the speech of his neighbor." The Hebrew word that I translate as confuse can also mean mix or pour out. The word translated as understand actually means hear or listen. So the verse can read, "Come on, let's go down and pour out their speech so that each doesn't listen to the speech of the other." There's something very believable about this, something very unsupernatural. Excitement mounts. Everyone starts talking at once. They pour out their speech in a terrible rush. No one hears what the other is saying or listens. And then God scattered them from there over the face of the whole earth, and they left off building the city. So please notice that the story doesn't say that the people stopped work on the tower, but that they left off building the city. They left off building that gathering place for all the people of the world. Also notice that the Bible doesn't say that God destroyed the place. The flames and the fury and the blood and the sky were added later by painters and rabbis and filmmakers. The scripture only says they left off building the city. So you could say it's more a tale of distraction than of destruction. Or maybe it's just a delay that comes to balance that earlier rush. The delay after Babel fills the greater part of the Bible until we near the end. So if we race ahead now into the New Testament, we find a story in the Acts of the Apostles. You may remember this one, where people have gathered on the day of Pentecost, 50 days after Passover, when suddenly there comes a sound from heaven, like the rush of a mighty wind, and it filled all the house where they were sitting. And there appeared to them tongues as of fire, distributed and resting on each one of them. So now they begin speaking in these tongues. Without dictionaries or any prior practice, the people find themselves speaking Greek and Arabic and Latin and a host of other languages. And this speaks volumes to me about a deep desire to overcome the barriers of language and nation and ethnic division. And this, I think, might really be the secret ark of the Bible, hiding in plain sight for hundreds and thousands of years. No, it is not possible to really begin speaking in a language to which you've never been exposed. What we hear in this tale of tongues is a deep desire to understand and to be understood. and a longing for where this is possible, a world where this is possible. So this unnoticed arc passes through the stories of Babel and Pentecost right through to the book of Revelation. You know the book of Revelation? The last book of the Bible is filled with countless images and scenes as wild as anything that painters, storytellers, or movie makers could produce, even with today's CGI techniques. Here's where you find the four horsemen of the apocalypse, the great beast whose mark is the number 666, the seven seals on seven scrolls that roll open before us, the great lake of fire swallowing up the wicked, and the trumpet blast that signals the end of the world. But it's the final great image that I want to leave you with today. The image of a city again, that descends from heaven to earth, a city with a great high wall with 12 gates, on the east 3 gates, on the north 3 gates, on the south 3 gates, and on the west 3 gates. And there is no temple in the city, for the temple is God himself. And the city has no need of sun or moon to shine upon it, for the glory of God is its light. By its light shall the nations walk, and its gates shall never be shut by day. And there shall be no night there. They shall bring into it the glory and honor of the nations, all the peoples. Such gates make the wall more inviting than empty space could ever be. Come inside, my children, to find your joy and peace in me. Imagine that, a wall that means welcome. The book calls this the New Jerusalem, but it's also the New Babel, a city for more than the people of the Bible or any single faith, a city that's open on all sides, welcoming us from every direction, from every land, and speaking every language, a self-illuminating city. What is this, if not a place of love and understanding, and at last, of real communication? From scattered space, we gather, from emptiness, to multitude. So let's reach out wide, reach up high, and reach down deep as we build this house of ours in this beautiful open city. We may be dizzied at times by how fast things come together. We may suffer slowdowns or setbacks, even some occasional confusion about language or design or procedures, but we'll make it. Brick by brick, from hand to hand, all the way to the top. As for building projects at Y East this year, I hope that we can start by making our own bricks. By that, I mean our own elevator speeches, figuring out how to describe our Unitarian Universalist religious movement in language that anyone can understand. Our Committee on Ministry will be leading two workshops that you heard about earlier to help do that on September 30th and October 11th. It's all in the newsletter. It'll all come out as an email. Later in the spring, I hope that we'll find a way to put those bricks together as we work together on a new vision and mission statement for this particular congregation, building on a foundation that was laid over 20 years ago, but now needs some updating. For architects like us, an unfinished tower is more inviting than a finished one, don't you think? The foundation is strong and ready. The greater part of the story still waits to be told. And what I mean by that is your story, mine and ours. After the Ark, after the Babel, and even after the Bible has done all the work that it can, let our common purpose be our common language. Finding that purpose may be the greater part of the story and the greatest part of all. So may it be.